Thanks, everyone, for joining us for this weekly conference call. Obviously, the most important thing happening on the Hill today was the passage of a two-week continuing resolution that keeps the lights on for the federal government, but even more importantly, cuts $4 billion in spending. This is a proportional cut representing the commitment on the House to cut a total of $100 billion, the rest of which will come with the longer-term continuing resolution bill that we will take up presumably in 2 weeks if the schedule holds. This is only a start. The fact of the matter is that even cutting $100 billion from the federal budget this year will not come close to where we need to be when it comes to returning austerity to the federal budget. We're still spending 40 cents out of every dollar in borrowed money, and the debt is now in excess of $14 trillion. And with entitlement spending in Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, we are in deep trouble as a nation, and this is a time for bold action. And I hope that working with the administration, we will do what we need to do in order to return not just austerity, but prosperity, which is the other important part of the equation, because, of course, cutting spending but having lagging private sector growth, which we have right now in high unemployment, is obviously not the the ultimate goal. Our goal is to get the private sector growing again and to create jobs and opportunity for the American people. To that end, this morning we had the Secretary of Energy testify in front of the Budget Committee, and I asked him about his stated concern over our dependency on imported energy from abroad, and particularly in light of the unrest we've seen in Libya and Egypt and throughout the Middle East, and the fact that gas prices have risen some 20 cents just since the unrest in Cairo. Now the average price of gas is $3.38 a gallon. You all remember what happened when gas prices hit $4.11 a gallon just a few short years ago, and what the impact it had on consumers around the country, on family budgets, and on businesses. This is a very serious threat to the United States from a national security perspective, but given the geopolitical instability of the region where most of our imported energy comes from, it seems to me it calls for a renewed commitment to a national energy policy that will produce more energy here at home, and not one that would burden the domestic energy industry sector with more taxes. Yet the president's budget itself calls for $46 billion in additional taxes on our domestic energy producers here for the next over the next 10 years. Exactly the wrong message that I think the administration and Congress ought to be sending. Yesterday, we had Secretary Arne Duncan of Education before the Budget Committee, and he testified about the president's budget in education, representing a some 11% growth, I believe it was, over the preceding year, which is extraordinarily odd given the fact that everybody believes that we need to cut spending rather than continue to grow spending. But that being the case, nevertheless, the administration did propose about 11% increase in education spending. I asked Secretary Duncan about the policies of the federal government, which have not only made it harder for us to fund our priorities like education at the federal level, but the effect of unfunded mandates like the Medicaid expansion in Texas, which has imposed $27 billion in additional spending just to keep up with Medicaid and now comprises 25% of our state budget. When the state is forced by the federal government due to this unfunded mandate to spend more tax dollars on the Medicaid expansion, in this case, that obviously crowds out funding for other priorities like education, recognizing that this is and should remain a high priority. Suffice it to say, the secretary didn't have any particularly satisfactory words about that, but at least I got a chance to raise that with the secretary. Finally, I asked him about the $830 million that's owed to the state of Texas out of the education jobs bill that passed last year. You'll recall that Congressman Doggett introduced an amendment to that bill which barred Texas from qualifying for that $830 million in aid unless the governor agreed to something that the Texas Constitution prohibits him from doing, that is to education funding limits, not just for this legislative session, but for successive legislative sessions, something the governor has no power to do, and indeed no legislature has the power to bind a future legislature. So I think I made the point with Secretary Duncan. He called me later in the day, and we're going to be getting together, hopefully, to negotiate a resolution of this impasse. It's simply unacceptable for the federal government to thumb its nose at the people of Texas and the very real needs of our K through 12 students and getting the financial support that this $830 million represents. Let me also mention, I talked a moment ago about Secretary Chu, the Secretary of Energy, and what I wanted to add in addition is the continued concern I have about the lack of new permits for deep water drilling in the Gulf of Mexico. Obviously, in Texas, being a Gulf Coast state, this has a big impact not only on jobs, but again, on our continued dependency on imported energy from abroad. And we know that even though a federal court has ordered the lifting of the moratorium, that the administration has been dragging its feet and has only just now on Monday approved the first new deep water drilling permit since April of last year. So this continues to be a big problem, not just for our state from a job standpoint, but from an energy standpoint and in terms of the cost of that energy in the form of gasoline and other forms of energy to our consumers at a time when they can't easily withstand increases in commodity prices like gasoline during this fragile economic recovery. Let me stop there and take a couple of questions.
Senator?
Yes, sir.
Hey, it's Dave Michaels from Dallas News. How are you?
Yes, sir, Dave.
I have a question a little bit on the left field here. I was wondering if you have
I won't say it's the first time, Dave.
Yeah.
No, I'm
okay.
Kidding.
It won't be the last either. I just was curious if you have a sense, based upon maybe contacts your office has had since the turmoil in Libya started, do you have a sense of will the sanctions or the turmoil that has engulfed Libya generally, how much is that going to disrupt business ties between Texas and Libya? Texas has the deepest trade ties of any state to Libya.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's going to have a significant impact because there is a civil war going on right now in Libya. For control with Colonel Gaddafi and his mercenaries on one hand and those who want opportunity and freedom and democratic reforms on the other. And that's one reason why I agree with Senator McCain that what we need to do is to impose a no-fly zone to keep Libyan jets from pilots from gunning down innocent protesters. And I also think that we need to do everything we can to encourage Colonel Gaddafi to leave and to that country so we can restore it to some – help restore it, and the Libyans themselves can help restore it to some level of normalcy. But the fact of the matter, Dave, is that it's not just Libya. It's all of these countries around the Middle East, ranging from Syria to Saudi Arabia to Lebanon to Iran. This is a contagion that threatens to spread throughout the region. And while on one hand we might say, well, that would be good to have some regime change, from particularly when you're talking about autocratic regimes, the problem is it could easily spill over into Islamic extremists and other religious leaders and establishing, in effect, a theocracy, not a democracy, in those regions. So it's a very serious concern in terms of disruption of commerce, particularly the oil supply, but it's also we don't know where it's going to end. That's why I think what we need to do is to help by imposing a no-fly zone at the very minimum.
Just ask you to follow up. I mean, U.S. in terms of U.S. policy in Libya generally, oil companies, multinationals, but many of them based in Texas, were pretty instrumental in sort of rehabilitating Libya to some degree in the eyes of the U.S. government. Do you think that that move, you know, when we lifted the embargo, is that called into question here, or did the U.S. not pressure Libya enough on democratic and government reform in the last 5 or 6 years? I mean,
well, I think a lot of people are asking those questions about U.S. policy relative to not just Libya but to Egypt and other autocracies there in the Middle East. And it's a very fragile situation because obviously we don't want Hezbollah or Hamas or the Muslim Brotherhood or some other religious organization taking control and basically then ruling in another sort of autocracy or dictatorship. We want to encourage those sorts of democratic reforms that you alluded to, although that's the tricky part, given the history of the region and given the threat that exists there. So I would say in 2004, I believe, is when the U.S. lifted many sanctions on Libya because they gave up their WMD and their nuclear weapons. You'll recall that happened shortly after the invasion of Iraq. And that was actually a very positive thing. So I won't gainsay that, but I will say it's a very tricky region, and we don't know exactly how it will all end.
Senator Stuart Powell.
Yes, sir.
I wanted to ask you a gun-related question. We've had two high-profile incidents recently, the shooting of Gabby Giffords and others, and also the ICE agent in Mexico. And yet there's sort of no outcry for additional gun regulations in Congress or even at the White House. And I just wonder whether you think the consensus has changed on gun regulation, or whether it's just a matter of political reality where nothing could get done because of the division of the government.
Well, Stuart, from my standpoint, I think it's a recognition that it's the shooter's responsibility, not the gun. And there are a lot of legitimate gun owners, including me, who own firearms for recreation and sporting activities and protection of our families and property. So, obviously, many questions have been raised, and I think those need to be pursued. For example, the shooter in Arizona, how he came by a weapon, and having demonstrated signs of serious mental illness. But I guess there is a closest thing to a consensus that I've seen on many issues that really just trying to impose more regulation on legitimate gun owners is not is much too broad a way to address the issue, and we need to be it needs to be more targeted, if you'll forgive the pun.
Senator, this is Jim Forsyth in San Antonio.
As long
as we're talking about this, what if I could follow up? There's been talk about changing the policy to allow and even encourage U.S. agents like Agent Zapata to carry firearms when they are on duty in the Republic of Mexico. Do you think that's a good idea, especially considering what recently happened to the U.S. CIA agent who was carrying a gun and actually firing it in Pakistan? Is that what we want to have our agents doing, is opening fire in Mexico?
Well, I had occasion to visit with Agent Zapata's mother and family yesterday on the telephone and express my condolences for their loss. But I believe that our professional law enforcement agents should have the right to defend themselves and should not be sent empty-handed and defenseless into harm's way. These are trained personnel, and people know how to use those firearms, when to use them and when not to use them. And I completely support the notion that all of our professional law enforcement officials, no matter where they serve, should have the right and ability to defend themselves.
Now, what's the response of the Mexican government to that, or has there been one?
I'm not aware specifically of a response to that. Although we work cooperatively with the Mexican government in law enforcement, obviously in the battle against the cartels and the like, obviously they have a different view toward public ownership or individual ownership of firearms in Mexico. To my knowledge, that does not extend to prohibition against professional law enforcement officers.
Senator Cornyn, Terry Gildane, San Antonio. Hey, do you have any comments about the Supreme Court's decision today to uphold the right of the Westboro Baptist Church to protest at military funerals? As a former Texas Supreme Court judge and Attorney General of the state, do you think this ruling really serves the First Amendment of the Constitution?
Well, I hate the message that they are conveying, but I think the First Amendment to the Constitution is not about the content of the message, but the right of every American to express themselves as long as they aren't provoking violence or crossing that very clear line. So I despise and hate the message that these individuals feel impelled to communicate, but I also at the same time understand why the Supreme Court would uphold their right under the First Amendment to say so. I think we are running out of time here, so if you'll forgive me, we're going to make that the last question and look forward to talking to you again soon. Thank you.